Hello, and welcome to another edition of From the Newsroom. Although, in this instance, we're not coming from the newsroom. We are in the Miller Center at Hope College.
Yes, the beautiful Miller Center.
Isn't this great?
Yes, this I cannot believe
first
how
time
awesome
here.
This place is.
Yeah, and the acoustics, you can immediately tell, are sensational.
Yes, state of the art.
So they had an interesting discussion tonight, courtesy of the Kirk Center. They were the hosts of the event, along with Hope College, featuring three speakers.
Very illustrious intellectual speakers. Yes.
Very much.
Yes.
And probably leaning conservative.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the topic of the conversation was Trump and the future of American democracy. It went for about an hour and a half,
mm-hmm.
hour 45 minutes.
Yep.
And we'll be fortunate enough, actually, to be speaking with the moderator, Hope College political science professor Jeff Paulette, in a few moments. And one of the speakers tonight, Mark Bauerlein.
Bauerlein. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You know, real quick off the top of your guys' head, I know Audra Gamble is joining us. I'm Brian Brunellos, digital director. I don't think we did introductions. Editor Sarah Leach is here as well.
Hello.
Audra, you were typing as fast as humanly possible, I think.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
What came to mind as you're furiously typing away and getting the transcript?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, I'd love to talk to Mark and Jeff a little bit about this more, but it seemed to me that the sort of thesis of what they were discussing is if Trump's version of being a Republican is going to have any effect on American conservatism, and what the lasting effects of that may be for the future of American politics.
And Sarah, your thoughts?
Well, I think that it was really interesting because they covered a lot of ground, like from the campaigning to the actual him winning the presidency to what his legacy is going to be. And so the conversation covered a huge variety, range of possibilities. So I think it was really interesting to see a true intellectual discussion being hashed out where it did not devolve into emotionally charged things. They were very frank about some certain realities about Trump and his presidency and the way that he's campaigned and some of the words and actions that he's put out there, but also his populist appeal to his base and why he was able to energize the public and be able to rally over all expectations of being able to win the presidency. And then I think at the end, what I thought was really interesting is that all three of them agreed that he is going to be in some way, shape, or form, a very defining figure in American politics. It's just, how is that going to be? Is he going to be like the bastion of a new party? Is he going to be the destructor of the established GOP? Is he going to basically just shake up politics completely? Is he going to be seen as a failure or as a success? And so that's kind of like where the conversation lies, and nobody really knows what's going to happen.
Right. And we should also mention, besides Mark Bauerlein, we also had two New York Times reporters. Well, current Times columnist Ross Douthat.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm blanking on he's a former book review, book editor in the New York
Sam
Times. Sam Tenenhouse,
and
thank you.
And he was the editor of the book review at the
Correct.
New York Times, yes.
Correct.
And, yes. And he's also doing a lot of work. Oh, sorry. Sam's also had a lot of interesting kind of historical perspective because he does a lot of biographing of political figures in America. And I really think that the venue of this talk was important too, in that, you know, having people sit down in this beautiful auditorium and kind of taking that space to talk in a little bit more nuance than you normally can in a 4-minute cable news segment, I think was very helpful to the voters in that they could really kind of get the multi-sided conversations happening that I think is lacking a little bit sometimes.
Right. Yeah, I think, sorry, we're sharing a mic. I think one of the great things about it is that there none of the speakers were either pro-Trump or anti-Trump firmly. I mean, they're realists, and they're saying, like, listen, if Trump can do X, Y, or Z, then these positive things or these negative things could result. I mean, they really are truly looking at it from an intellectual perspective. And I think that that is really lacking in a lot of like you were saying, in the media spaces where we see it, there's all these pundits, there's a lot of animosity. They even talked about the media coverage and whether or not the media is unduly attacking Trump in an unprecedented way. And spoiler alert, they said yes. but there's a bigger explanation for that. And I think that when we have them on a little bit later, I think that it'll be really good to get into those sorts of issues.
Okay. That mention of media attack popped up toward the end. It was the last question I asked.
I think that was the only question that they actually got to the audience, because
the audience.
That conversation took off organically. Like, I don't think anyone anticipated.
Right. And speaking as far as the crowd tonight, I think the Kirk Center people were, we'll say they were pleasantly surprised at the turnout, because they were not planning on opening the balcony.
Yep, where we are perched right now.
We're in the concert hall at the Miller Center, if you're familiar. And it was a full house on the mezzanine level, and they had to open up the balcony for, you know, for a few overflow people. So very engaging, and I was walking on the floor taking some photos, and we will have audio of the entire forum.
I call it a discussion.
Discussion,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's why you're editor, and I'm just a lowly grunt taking pictures. So we will have the entire audio of the discussion on our website under this podcast as well, so you can go and listen to that. So we are joined now by Professor Mark Bauerlein from Emory College, and Hope College political science professor Jeff Paulette, who was the moderator for this evening's discussion. Audra, our Holland Sentinel reporter here, was furiously typing the transcript. I've never seen fingers fly like that. And I know she had some questions for you guys as far as the discussion, how it evolved tonight.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for joining us, you guys. It seemed to me that throughout the debate, I mean, you touched on so many different topics throughout, but it seemed to me that the kind of joining thread is if Trump was somehow changing conservatism in America. And I'd love to hear kind of both of your responses to if it is changing and if it can survive or outlast what Trump is doing to it.
Are you asking, can Trumpism survive Trump?
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that a lot of people are asking these days. I mean, in part, it depends on what you define Trumpism as. In some ways, he's an unusual vehicle for a series of cultural and political trends. Right? If one of the things that came up throughout the conversation was the idea that there are real problems with the middle class in America, and that Trump was sort of tapping into the decline of the middle class and a lot of the economic and cultural issues that they face. And he's an odd person to be the person that they choose to do that. I mean, why this guy exactly? And I think one of the things that works for Trump, or two of the things that work for Trump, one is that he's just not politics as usual. You know, the things he says are not focus group tested. They're not run through opinion polls. They don't go through multiple drafts by highly skilled elite speech makers or so. He speaks from the cuff, and I think it's unusual. And if people are living in a political system that they think is broken, and they have somebody who doesn't talk like everybody else, you know, that gives them, I think, some hope that maybe he's the right person to fix it. And the second thing is his wealth insulates him in a certain sense, and that is he doesn't need the job. He doesn't need the money, and he can't be bought. And I think that's a concern a lot of people have about politicians, is that they're bought and sold. And a guy who's that wealthy can't be bought. And the fact that he talks the way he does sort of reinforces that idea, right, that he's nobody's stoolie. He can kind of be himself, and he can go in there, and he can disrupt the whole system that's not working as far as they're concerned.
To the question of whether conservatism will survive Trump or will change because of Trump, I put it in terms of one aspect of conservatism, and that is its take on culture. You know, conservative culture is a view that treasures the past, that believes Western civilization is a noble inheritance, that we believe in forms of high culture and decorous behavior, and the recognition of the Enlightenment virtues of truth and free inquiry and universal humanity. What we've seen in the last 50 years in this country is a deterioration of all those things. Our world is much more coarse and vulgar. Our respect for the past has gone down significantly. Instead of believing in Martin Luther King's vision of universal humanity, we've sunk into identity politics, breaking people up into groups and assigning value or blame accordingly. And on all those scores, conservatism, I think, has been an abject failure. It has not stopped the decay in any of those areas. And the identity politics, in particular, along with the political correctness that goes with it, was one of the keys for the advent of Donald Trump and for his success. He broke all the rules. I mean, when we reach a point where saying Black Lives Matter is fine, and it is fine, but saying all lives matter is a crime, as it is in the Democratic Party now, we're in big trouble. And Trump came along, and no apologies, no explanations, all lives matter. That roused a lot of people who have felt like they're in a constant straitjacket in our culture. As long as we have powerful identity politics and political correctness, we're going to have the Trump phenomenon continue. And the Democratic Party, the sounder voices in the Democratic Party have said, you've got to abandon this identity liberalism, as it's called. Those people have been shouted down. Now, I don't know if that will continue. If the Democrats, it could be, it all depends on the performance in 2018. The war on women seems to have stopped. That was a very successful campaign in 2012. It was a failure in 2014 for the Democrats, and it was certainly a failure last year. So that one seems to have gone away. We'll see if the racial politics continues, if in the Democratic Party, and it'll all depend on the vote. If the Democrats lose more seats in 2018, they may finally pull away from the identity politics that they have embraced so soundly. If they win, we're going to get a lot more of it.
There's a standard phrase among conservatives that the politics is always downstream from the culture. Right. So if the culture has been coarsened, if the culture has been vulgarized, the politics will become coarsened and vulgarized also. If the culture is deeply polarized and deeply divided, the politics will be deeply divided. So in a certain sense, Donald Trump is a mirror image of ourselves.
During the conversation tonight, Mark, you talked about Donald Trump lacking that machine behind him that we're used to from GOP candidates of having those kind of mid-level positions filled by normal party individuals.
Right. People in the think tanks.
Right, right.
People who worked for the campaign. I mean, Donald Trump had a small campaign network, organization.
Sure. So
much smaller than usual.
So I'm wondering if it has surprised you in any way how that political machine that is the GOP has responded post-election to Trump's presidency.
Yeah, I was expecting this. I mean, I'd been a political appointment before, again, as a very low level. So I'd seen how important it is. This was in W's administration from 2003 to 2005. I'd seen how important. I mean, the federal government is massive. It is a huge monolith. Just go to Washington, D.C. and walk around. You can see how many people the president has to rely upon to implement anything. You can't just appoint your cabinet officials and maybe an undersecretary here and there. You need a deep state. You need what Trump called the swamp. But you just need better people in there. Trump, he didn't have... I mean, look, he declared war on all the all the organizations. I mean, he declared war on Hera, you know, AEI, and a lot of the think tanks. He declared war on a lot of the people who supported the other candidates. Now, he brought some of them in, like Nikki Haley. He did consult with the Heritage Foundation after he came into office, but you know, his main advisor early on, Steve Bannon, was in an adversarial relationship to everyone in Washington. So this was just on a practical level, the chaos, the confusion. This was inevitable.
Jeff, do you have any response to the GOP versus Trump debate?
Well, there is a interesting thing going on. It's always there's an old political thinker who once said American politics isn't really about the relationship between the president and the Congress. It's about the relationship between the president and the people. And so one of the issues is how does that get mediated? And you can create all kinds of complex systems to try to mediate the relationship between presidents or presidential candidates and the population. What Trump did is he blew that all up. And that has repercussions for our governance also, because those institutions that help mediate those kinds of relationships also help kind of grease the skids of governance. And they make governance work. So when you blow those up in the campaign process, you're also kind of blowing them up in the governing process. And it's going to make governing really quite difficult. But it's how he could win, right? He had to completely bypass all the systems that were in place in order to do that. And so part of it is a kind of indication of just the weaknesses of our political parties.
The last question that I have is something that was kind of hammered a lot tonight during the conversation is that Trump doesn't so much excel on talking about the details of policy. He steps back and lets Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan take the forefront on that. So if the things that succeeded in the election cycle were Trump's personality and his differences, if you were to see real policy from him, what do you think the things would be on the top of that agenda?
Can I answer that question by ignoring it? in this
we'll
sense.
Try it.
I'll get to it. Our system's not designed to have presidential legislation. It's designed to have congressional legislation. Presidents aren't supposed to have really detailed policy agendas, right? So one of the interesting things that Trump has done is he's kicked policy back to Congress. So think about the immigration thing, for example, where he issued the executive order about DACA, he turned to Congress and he said, "You guys fix this, because you're the policy arm of the federal government. Right? You're the legislative arm of the federal government. That's your job, is to have a detailed legislative agenda." So when he kicks it to McConnell and Ryan, in a certain sense, he's doing what the system is designed to do and what presidents have not been doing the space of a century now. They've not been doing that. So in that sense, I think it's actually kind of an interesting thing. What would he put at the top of it? I imagine he'd probably put trade at the top of it. I think that's an issue that really animates him.
I think you're right, Jeb. I think the question is right. Trump doesn't care so much about the policy details, and he's almost like a CEO. I see a problem here. The public schools, they're a mess. They're underperforming. Let me get the right person in here who can do something about it. And so he brings in Betsy DeVos, and she's, you know, charter school world vouchers and so on. She's got a record there. He didn't want to bring someone in who was going to be close to the unions, close to any of the establishment of the public schools. This would be the kind of person. So turn it over to her. And you don't hear Trump giving policy speeches about education. You don't hear him talking about education very much. He just wants to fix. I see a problem, fix it. So turning it over to the right people. So it all depends on this personnel question. Right? Do you get someone who is going to run this agency who can perform? And the worry is that, to come back to the other issue, that some of these agencies are so big, getting one person, getting the right person at the top, is not enough. You got to get 10 people in there to make it work.
One of the things that I obviously find pretty interesting about the entire discussion is obviously how media is covering the presidency and how the public's perception of the way that the media is covering the presidency, what kind of an effect, you know, what's feeding the beast? Is it the media's criticism of it, or is Trump antagonizing the media to cause the criticism? So, you know, it kind of gets into this vicious cycle. And what we're seeing at the local level is that this is trickling down to where I'm sure a lot of community papers are in a similar position, where they are obliged to pick up some of the national coverage that is available to us on news services and the like. So we're dependent on that. But then when we pick that up, because we don't have the ability to independently cover it and dispatch reporters to Washington and so forth, then we get the criticism by proxy of the national media because they're too hard on Trump. So that's been a real struggle for us. And I was wondering what kind of insight you might have on that, and what local papers might be able to do to try to mitigate that sort of a trickle-down effect that we're seeing on the local level.
That's a tough one.
I mean, part of that is, you know, and this didn't really come up tonight. It was on my list of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, part of the problem in our political system is, as I said, first of all, the presidency is just much more important than it's supposed to be. If presidential elections become the central ritual of a democratic system, the democratic system is done for.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, the federal government is supposed to be the government of last resort, not the government of first resort. So I would say, and I think the Sentinel does a good job with this, I would say the first obligation of a local newspaper is to cover local politics, and the second obligation of a local newspaper is to cover state politics, and the last resort obligation of a local newspaper is to cover national politics. It's the internet age, right? People can get national politics all the time. It's cable television. They can get it all the time.
You know, there's an interesting thing. I have a close friend who's an anchor in Atlanta for the local news. The local news is holding steady there, TV news, because it's the only place where people can get local TV. The national news, you know, networks, they're suffering, but people, I think the mission right here, first of all, is local happenings. What's the mayor doing?
One of the things that we see, I just had a meeting with our reader advisory board. We have a local reader advisory board of 20 or 30 local readers, and so we meet once a month. We talk about the things that the Sentinel is doing, things that they're thinking about doing, et cetera, just to get some general feedback, some sort of a mechanism to get that you know, message back and forth. And they were saying that they appreciated reading national copy in print because you get more of it. You get a little bit more analysis. When they're going online, they're not reading for very long. When they're seeing it on television, you're only getting maybe 30 seconds. And so they get more details that way. So when we actually scale back some of the national stuff that we get criticized because why didn't you have this in the paper? That, you know, so it's a very fine line to walk. And I don't want to make this too much about the Sentinel or about, you know, local community newspapering, but I think that it's really interesting about how this is in an unprecedented era with an unprecedented president, and how to be able to report what's happening, where sometimes it defies all you know, previous understandings of how a president should behave and operate. And when that's perceived as criticism, you know, the media really does take it on the chin sometimes. And I think that that's a real struggle when you're trying to present just the news of the day.
Yeah, and I think it drags everybody down. I think that's probably true. But the ballast there is the integrity in the local reporting in a certain sense.
Yeah.
You know, if they know that, right, the Sentinel cares about this community, and is deeply concerned about the well-being of this community, that could bleed over the other way also, right? And they say, well, you know, if they can be trusted to deal with the stuff that we see around us every day, right, and that we're experiencing in this place that we share with them, well, then they can probably be trusted in other things also. So I think part of that is just the integrity of the local reporting But the big picture is, that's a difficult mess. And part of it is that the national media, when Trump was elected, I mean, you can go, we were talking about this last night, David Rubnick from The New Yorker said, obviously, we're going to have to change from being a reporting agency to being an adversarial agency. We need to block this presidency. So they made that their mission from that point forward. Well,
and therefore, there was a trickle down effect because there's a lot of labeling of all media in that sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think on that note, we will thank both of you gentlemen for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time out. I know you guys were, it was a great discussion tonight and very enjoyable.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked it.
Thank you. Thank you. If you weren't here, it was a really thought-provoking and very enjoyable conversation to hear.
Absolutely.
These three intellectual giants, mm-hmm. conservative giants, mm-hmm. talking on the stage here. And any final thoughts from Sarah, Audra?
Well, I think that I already said I'm just really impressed with the depth and of the discussion and the level of analysis that they were able to apply so quickly when the conversation would pivot from topic to topic. And I really encourage any listeners to the podcast to listen to the full audio, because I think that no matter what your political affiliation might be, I think that this was a quality discussion that would appeal to just about everybody. It really does. It's a fair look at how Trump became president and what it means for the country. And I think that that's a really good discussion to be having right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciated throughout the entire conversation the historical perspective mm-hmm. that they continued to bring in. I mean,
the comparisons.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when you have scholars debating this, they have so much to draw upon.
Right.
And I mean, comparing different political analysis and different strategies.
Numbers, how many of the presidents won a second term in consecutive president administrations, and using the historical comparison to that, and then also bringing in the comparison of the 1968 assassinations event.
Yeah, I thought
Martin
that was
Luther
very
King
interesting.
And
yeah,
RFK. I thought that was a really really interesting point, and I'm not going to explain what any of that means, because you have to go and listen to the full audio.
Yeah. No, I think that was particularly poignant. I mean, when you're speaking to a crowd of college kids that definitely weren't alive. You know, in 1968, to see those riots at the mm-hmm. conventions.
Mm-hmm. And that we have been through harder times. It's hard.
Right.
It's hard.
Yes.
To, you know, those who are frustrated amongst us, there is a little bit of perspective. Not to say that we would ever want to return to those times, as they did qualify after they mentioned it. But yeah, we have been through tough times, and we will go through more tough times. But this too shall pass.
Well, on that note, thank you, ladies. Audra, you came in relief. We went to the bullpen. We called the closer.
I'm happy to be here.
She came in. Wow, what a dominant performance.
Yes, absolutely.
So thank you on behalf of Audra Gamble, Sarah Leach. I'm Brian Brunellis, and thank you for listening. Actually, we should start calling this from the balcony, because it seems like a lot of these podcasts we've been doing.
I like it, yeah.
Like the eye on the sky.
from the balcony, whether it's the Knickerbocker or the Miller Center. So thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.